From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. And today we'll listen again to some of the most compelling stories in our show this year. We'll start with Laura Ling recalling her months in a North Korea prison. She and her sister Lisa, the TV journalist, were raised in Sacramento and the family still lives here. The sisters wrote a book about Laura's capture and imprisonment and the family's efforts to get her released. Their book is called Somewhere Inside. Laura and Lisa Ling joined us in September. I asked Laura when she first realized that she and her colleague Yuna Lee were in big trouble.
This was March 17th of last year, and we were filming along the Tumen River, the frozen Tumen River that separates China and North Korea, doing a story on the trafficking of women from North Korea. We were on that river to document the thoroughfare where so many people are being trafficked. And we were with a local fixer at the time. A local fixer is a guide who foreign journalists often hire when we work overseas. And this guide was walking across the ice. This is somebody who we placed a lot of trust in. And he beckoned for us to follow. And we did. I don't blame the guide. I don't say this to blame the guide. I just say that everything happened so quickly. We followed him. We ended up at the other side of the river, and then we turned around to leave. And
so you were briefly in North Korea.
We were for about a minute, and we turned around to leave. We walked back across the ice, and that's when we heard yelling. I turned around and saw two North Korean soldiers with their rifles raised in the air chasing after us. I ran for my life back onto Chinese soil, and I thought perhaps if I can make it back to China, everything would be okay. But they pursued us onto Chinese soil and proceeded to drag my colleague and me back across the ice very violently until we were back in North Korea, and that's when I knew that things were not good.
Lisa, when and how did you first hear about this awful event?
I found out probably about 10 hours after they had been abducted. I found out at about 2:30 in the morning on the morning of March 17th, and it was my sister's husband who called me, and there was another colleague of theirs who was able to escape, and so he was able to call his family, and they reached out to Laura's colleagues who reached out to our family. But it was definitely one of the most challenging things to hear, especially because Laura had never said that they were going anywhere near North Korea. So when my brother-in-law said Laura's been abducted by North Korean border guards, I was just absolutely shocked. I knew they would be going to China and South Korea, but there was never any plan to go to North Korea.
So what did you and your family do at that point? What was the first thing you did?
Well, the first thing my family and I did was call Vice President Gore, who was the chairman or is the chairman of Current TV, Laura's former employer. And I also called my mother to start calling contacts in China because she speaks Mandarin Chinese. And I started calling my diplomatic contacts in the United States. But we had to tread very, very carefully because, one, North Korea is the most sensitive an isolated country on earth, but two, it was a country that I had visited in 2007 and worked on a very critical documentary. And my biggest fear was that they would somehow connect Laura to me and think that we were somehow trying to commit espionage.
Laura, did you ever hear that you were somehow connected to that, that the North Korean authorities knew about that, and or that they knew about your connection to a former vice president, i.e. Al Gore?
Sure. Well, yes, I was upfront with my connection to Vice President Gore, and I knew that I couldn't lie about that. And they proceeded to ask me a lot of questions, asking if I was involved with this, if I was, you know, part of the CIA, et cetera.
You know, media company owned by former vice president of the United States, you can see how they would be very suspicious.
But I wasn't so forthcoming about my sister. My sister, her job or her past work in North Korea. I did say that she was a correspondent, and I left it at that. And one day, my interrogator walked into the room with a big blue dossier. And he asked me, has your sister ever been to North Korea? And I knew that I couldn't lie. I said yes, and we proceeded to talk about her work there.
When was the first time you were actually able to talk either to someone from your family or even just someone from the United States?
Well, I was able to meet with the Swedish ambassador, and the United States and North Korea don't have any direct diplomatic relations, so everything goes through Sweden. I met with the Swedish ambassador for a total of about 15 minutes, and this was a couple of weeks into our captivity. Seeing him was the brightest light during that time up till then. And then I knew I needed to talk to my family, specifically Lisa, because I knew that she could perhaps try to move the needle. And I begged and begged my interrogator, please let me call my sister. She might have some contact. So even though Lisa was viewed as an enemy for her work that she had done there previously, I think that they saw an opportunity there. They allowed me to call her about a month and a half into my captivity.
My guests are Laura and Lisa Ling. They're co-authors of Somewhere Inside, One Sister's Captivity in North Korea, and Others Fight to Bring Her Home. Lisa, what were you and your family advised by the State Department? Because you're well known in the United States. People are used to seeing you and hearing you on TV, and people were probably wondering, you know, what you could say and what you couldn't say.
Well, for months, we didn't say anything because we were so paranoid and nervous about saying anything that might offend the North Korean government. So it wasn't until Laura was able to call me and I heard her voice say, it's been too quiet. That was sign enough for me that we need to launch a media campaign, essentially, and start raising the profile of this situation. But we had to still do so very carefully. So when we did finally decide to go public, everything that came out of our mouths was, they were words of deference and respect and apology. We're so sorry if any kind of mistake was made, if they inadvertently crossed into North Korea. We appeal to your mercy and humanity, and we beg you to release my sister and her colleague.
Yeah. Laura, you eventually were sentenced to, I think, 12 years of hard labor. Did you expect a sentence as severe as that?
Well, I was trying to prepare myself for a tough sentence just because North Korea is such a mysterious country, and considering its relations with the U.S. A lot of people don't realize that the sentence was actually broken down into two parts, and it was 2 years for trespassing, but the majority of the sentence, 10 years, was for the work that we were doing as journalists and the story that we were doing about North Korean defectors.
Did you actually start doing hard labor?
I didn't. After the trial, they sent me to a hospital where they gave me a full medical evaluation, and they determined that I wasn't fit to serve in the labor camp. I have multiple ulcers, but I don't know if they were doing that because they were trying to buy some time for some sort of negotiation. I was thankful that I was not sent.
Did you have those ulcers before you were arrested?
I did.
Yeah, but they, fortunately for you, you still had them, because otherwise you may have been sent somewhere. But they actually, Laura had to undergo a procedure there that was
right.
Quite
I mean,
brutal.
North Korea is one of the poorer countries in the world, and so they don't have the same technology that we have here. And I've had many stomach scopes done to examine my ulcers here in the U.S., where they give you anesthesia and you don't feel a thing. Well, there is no anesthesia, and the equipment they have is very outdated. It was like a hose being placed down my throat to look into my stomach.
Oh, my goodness.
It was incredibly painful, but at the end of the day, perhaps it was good.
It confirmed that she had a medical condition.
How did Bill Clinton get involved? Lisa, did you know that Bill Clinton was involved?
I did, and the reason, and that's sort of the question that most people wonder, why Bill Clinton? And Laura was allowed to call me four times only, and all of these calls were very heavily monitored. And in the very last call, she said, if we are released, there has to be some kind of envoy, and it has to be Bill Clinton. And the reason is because the leader of North Korea always wanted to meet Bill Clinton, as strange as it sounds.
Oh my goodness.
But it all comes down to something that happened 15 years ago. And President Clinton told Laura this story when they were all on the plane together, that when his father, the great leader Kim Il-sung, died, Bill Clinton was the first leader to call him, even before his allies. And it was that gesture of humanity and respect that he had always remembered.
Laura, what was it like when you heard that your apparent freedom was imminent, but before it actually happened?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I had gone from one of the lowest lows to one of the highest highs, because prior to learning that this envoy was going to be to get us, I was very sick. I was hooked up to an IV drip for several days, running fever for several days. And then I heard that somebody, an important envoy, was going to be landing in Pyongyang. I got chills, and really it was just such a miraculous moment.
Funny story, President Clinton traveled with a physician, and President Clinton was asking Laura, are you okay? Do you want my physician to check you out? I was like, you know what, whatever I have,
yeah,
nothing that home can't cure.
Right. He said, we need to make sure you're okay to fly. And I knew that the swine flu epidemic was going around, and I didn't want to say that, oh, I've had a fever. I said, I feel just fine. Just get me back home.
And when you were safely back home, what was that like? I know it's an obvious question, but what a moment it must have been.
It was actually it was awkward at first. I was so desperate to see my family, but I was nervous at the same time. I was nervous to see how my parents had changed and if my situation had changed them, and the same with my sister and my husband. I was nervous that I knew that there would be so much media at the Burbank airport where we landed. I'm used to being on the other side of I'm not used to be the one being covered. And it was also hard to articulate full sentences. I hadn't really spoken English at great length. So all of that was an adjustment. And just seeing my family, that just made everything better.
Lisa Ling, as someone who's traveled the world a lot yourself, covering stories and issues, how has Laura's experience and what you went through, how has that changed you and the way you think about your work and your life?
Well, I obviously wasn't the one who was arrested and held captive, but I feel more strongly than ever that journalism needs to be practiced. There are so many stories in the world and here domestically that aren't being told, and it seems like there are fewer and fewer outlets these days to tell these stories. And I hope that if anything comes out of this, it's that people will be inspired to know more about the conflict inside North Korea and on the border between North Korea and China. It's a real humanitarian crisis. And just because Laura and her colleague were returned home doesn't mean that that story is over by any means.
And Laura, you no longer work for Current TV. You are now also a mother.
I am.
What are your plans?
I'm still a huge champion of what Current is doing and the stories that they're trying to tell. I'm taking a little bit of time to spend with my baby girl, and I also will continue doing journalism and reporting. I might start a little closer to home just to begin with.
Yeah. Laura Ling and Lisa Ling, they're co-authors of Somewhere Inside, One Sister's Captivity in North Korea and the Other's Fight to Bring Her Home. Laura Ling, Lisa Ling, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the surprising story of a woman who was raised by a white father who thought he was black. listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're listening to some of the best stories this year on our show. Next, the unusual childhood of Mishna Wolf, brought up in an inner-city Seattle neighborhood by a white father who thought he was black. She wrote about this in a memoir called I'm Down and joined us on Insight in June. I asked Mishna why her father decided to dress and act the way he did.
Well, I mean, I think he grew up after civil rights. He was very involved as a teenager in sort of the Panthers. He helped out with the breakfast program, and he was an athlete. So a lot of his friends were, you know, other black athletes. And he moved into a neighborhood that when he moved there, or when his parents moved there, I should say, it was a predominantly white and Asian neighborhood. It was relatively mixed. And then it slowly, you know, with school busing and in the 70s got, you know, sort of more and more African-American. So as that happened, it's actually then they stayed and the neighborhood changed.
What's his ethnic background?
He's white from Canada. So, you know, I think he says he identified a lot with black culture because he came from Canada and he felt like sort of an outsider.
Of course.
Yeah. I don't know why. You know, he said he felt like an outsider. He had wool pants and that made him feel really, you know, like an outsider. But you know, from the time I was born, he was pretty much always completely integrated into black culture.
So it wasn't some sudden thing that happened to him?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it happened gradually as the neighborhood changed, you know, so did he a little bit and his friends. And I also think, you know, it had a lot to do with, you know, playing sports. I mean, he was a big football player all through high school, going into, you know, one semester of college. And, you know, he also played basketball. And
many people have memories of their dad trying to act hipper than he really is.
Right.
Did you feel that way about your dad?
No, not at all. I felt like my dad was the coolest, hippest person in the whole entire world. Like, I was the one that felt always like the square. I mean, I was constantly trying to hip it up and, you know, failing miserably. I mean, the book's a lot about just how unbelievably cool he was and how hard it was for me to be not quite a little bit out of step.
My guest is Mishna Wolf. She's author of the memoir I'm Down. The book is about being raised by her father, who's white, but who considered himself part of black life, black culture. And this was in Seattle. Did he want you, expect you, make you to look and act the way he did?
Well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't that he expected me to look and act the way he did. He just didn't. By the time I was born and growing up, he didn't really even interface that much with white culture. So he just expected me to act what he thought was normal, you know. So we would go to like Black Baptist Church every week. And, you know, I played on an all black basketball team and I went to Boys and Girls Club that was, you know, all African-American. And I just was expected to not be weird and fit in, you know, which was, you know, I was the only white kid everywhere. So it was, you know, it was hard to be not weird.
Did you ever get the sense that people, either black people or white people, were laughing at your dad?
Yeah, absolutely. But that didn't come for me until much, much later. I mean, as a really young child, at least at this where the book starts out, I really had no idea that my dad wasn't the coolest person in African-American culture as well as white culture. I mean, he just sort of exuded this, you know, he was a big personality. And as I got older, you know, people sort of, you know, wink, wink, nod, nodded behind his back. But I wasn't privy to that when I was younger.
Did you think of yourself when you were young as a white person living as if you were black, or did you see yourself as just no different from the people in your neighborhood?
No, I mean, I felt like it. Things. I mean, a lot of what inspired me to write the memoir is these moments where certain things dawned on me, you know. And there was a moment that it really dawned on me that I was white, and that was probably not a great thing, you know. At least,
really,
yeah. It hit me one day and very suddenly that, you know, there was something different about me. And it was not something that the other kids necessarily picked up on because we were too young, but it was something that their parents really sort of enforced, or there was a weird vibe around me and some of the other parents.
Mishna Wolf is author of the memoir I'm Down. How does your father look today? How does he act today?
Well, I mean, my father still looks pretty much the same. He acts, you know, pretty much the same. He's he's grown in a lot of ways from the person I mean, this book is, you know, race and class is the backdrop for sure. But the book is a lot about my relationship with him during a period of both our lives where, you know, he was going through some stuff and I was going through some stuff. So, I mean, he's got a nice wife who's also African-American. He had an African-American wife in the book, and he has his second African-American wife. And, you know, he has an African-American stepson and step-grandson who he's great with, you know. So, you know, he's totally integrated into his neighborhood still. But he's a lot humbler and, you know, a little more defeated than he was at the time in the book.
Looking at you today, you don't look like someone trying to fit into a predominantly black neighborhood.
No, I don't think I do.
How did things change for you and why?
Well, when I was about 7 years old, I got accepted into a program for the highly gifted in Seattle, and it was in across town. I had to take a bus, and it was full of like the richest white kids I've ever met in my entire life. I mean, they had boats, they had ponies. You know, they didn't have to go to the library to use the encyclopedia. They had their own reference materials at home. It was pretty crazy for me. So,
what did they think of you?
They thought I was too ghetto. So. Not only was I too white at home, I was too black in my school. And, you know, and it sort of manifested itself in different ways. Like when I was at home, we would do the dozens to sort of, you know, we called it capping, to sort of assert our superiority over each other. And it was just this banter that went back and forth.
But were you good at it?
I got pretty good at it, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I wasn't the best.
Yeah.
And it's not the most original. I mean, it's not the most original comedic form. A lot of it's borrowed.
It's the your mama type stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a lot of recycled ones. So you hear one here, you use it over there. It's not, you know, I mean, there's very few people that write their own.
Do you go back to the old neighborhood?
Yeah, all the time. All the time. But, you know, I mean, I've got to say, like a lot of inner city neighborhoods, it's changed a lot. I mean, it's gentrified. It's, you know, there's now a lot of, you know, young gay and lesbian couples and, you know, a lot more, you know, sort of, you know, hippie types and stuff like that in the neighborhood I used to live in.
There have been several memoirs in the last few years that have gotten a lot of publicity because it turned out they were made up or partly made up. The story that you tell in I'm Down is so astonishing. How should people know whether to believe you?
Well, there's pictures.
That's true.
That helps. You know? There's a lot of pictures. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't feel astonishing to me. And a lot of people that write me, I mean, I get a lot of letters from people who grew up in mixed race neighborhoods or were the only black people in an all white school. I have a lot of African American fans. I get a lot of letters from people who were the only white people. I mean, for my generation of kids that grew up after civil rights and after the 70s, this is not astonishing. It's very normal. You know, we grew up in a period where race and class had certainly like mobilized itself a lot. And there was really not the same kind of rules there were before. There wasn't the same kind of order, particularly on the West Coast.
Yeah, there are photos and I've seen the photos. But I need to ask about the photograph on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
With this girl with this crazy afro.
Yeah,
that must be Photoshop.
This is Photoshop. Yeah, yeah. This is not my hair. This is this is what I'm going to call representational.
Yes. What does your dad think about the book?
You know, I think he was, I mean, it's comedic, the book. So I think he was happy of, you know, the lightness of the tone. I don't think I could write a book. I mean, to me, tragedy in writing is when three people are right at the same time. You know, and they're all in conflict with each other. And until I could find everyone's point of view in the book, I wasn't really able to write it. So, you know, I understand where he was coming from and what was going on with him. I understand what was going on with my stepmother during the time a little bit better. And I understand a little bit better, you know, sort of how the changes that I went through during that period. So I think he felt like it was actually more even and balanced than he had expected. And he actually bought 10 copies, like right out of the gate. So it's pretty happy.
Mishna Wolf's memoir is titled I'm Down. You've had a lot of coverage of this, a lot of good reviews. But when I went to the Amazon page for your book, there were a couple of people who didn't like it. And now, for all I know, these are two girls who you knew at school and hated you, and so who knows.
Right.
But the common theme in their complaints was one thought that your book was somewhat racist, and the other one thought you were stereotyping both black and white people. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think they finished the book. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, a memoir is about a character arc. So if you don't get to the end of the book, you don't know what the changes were. You know what I mean? It's like you don't have a coming of age story if someone doesn't learn anything and their perspective doesn't change. I mean, the point of a coming of age story is about a change in perspective. So, you know, I mean, I said, you know, I have a lot of African-American fans, and, you know, it's a pretty well-rounded book if you get to the end.
Mishna Wolf, author of the memoir I'm Down. Mishna Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, how a Loomis woman became host of a hunting and fishing reality TV show. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're listening again to some great stories from Insight this year. In September, you met a Loomis woman who hosts a hunting and fishing reality TV show. Jamie Suslin is a former police officer and now a realtor. She's been hunting and fishing ever since she was little. When Jamie joined us in Insight in September, I asked her how she got into the TV business.
Well, actually, I met the producer at a hunting and fishing, it was basically a conservation fundraiser. And after that, he saw me at speaking at a national convention, actually two national conventions, for large hunting and conservation organizations. And I was speaking in front of a few thousand people, and he knew that I had a passion for hunting and fishing, and he actually was looking for a host for his television show at that time. So he said, you know, would you possibly be interested in doing this? And I said, well, let me think about it. Yes, of course I would. Obviously I needed to get a little more information on it, but yeah, it was something that I was definitely interested in.
And what happens on the show?
Well, the show is comprised of 12 contestants from throughout the U.S. and Canada. They're competing in various fishing and hunting competitions, along with challenges. And each of those contestants will be eliminated. And there will ultimately be one left that will earn the right to call themselves the ultimate sportsman.
My guest is Jamie Suslin, host of The Ultimate Sportsman, a hunting and fishing reality TV show on the Versus channel. She lives in Loomis. I haven't seen the show, but I did watch the trailer online, and it starts with you riding up on this horse in this, I don't know where it is. Is it near Loomis?
No, that wasn't in Loomis.
You never know.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I believe that was in New Mexico where we filmed that.
Yeah. What's your role on the program?
I host the show, so I lead the contestants through each of their challenges. I bring in the show, I take the show out, and basically give support to the contestants along the way as well.
Do you do any hunting and fishing on the show?
I didn't do it on the show, although I do that in my personal life. One of the difficulties would be when we were fishing, say, on the Bitterroot River in Montana, the contestants had to fish. Well, our boat went ahead of everyone. So if I were fishing, I'd be taking their fish and taking their opportunity. So rather than messing that up for them, it was much better that I refrained from doing it. But I have to tell you, it was very difficult because I really wanted to be doing what the contestants were doing.
You got into hunting and fishing when you were very young. Is that because one of your parents or both of your parents were into it too?
Well, my stepfather basically introduced me to hunting. I got my first BB gun when I was 6 years old, and we lived on about 3.5 acres in southwestern Pennsylvania. So I would just roam around with my BB gun shooting tin cans and such. And then when I was 10 years old, I got my first rifle, and my stepfather took me out deer hunting. And in Pennsylvania, I think they still do, during the first day, opening day of school, they close down school for the opening day of deer season.
My goodness.
Yeah. So it was a very popular sport there.
What did you think about it the first time you killed an animal or caught a fish, which ultimately involves killing the fish too?
Well, actually, I do a lot of fly fishing, which is catch and release.
That's true. As soon as I said it, I realized that you don't have to kill the fish in the process of fishing.
Right. Absolutely. The killing of the animal isn't, or the harvesting of the animal, that's not the, you know, that's a sad time, really. I mean, truly, I think for a hunter, it's a sad time. That's not the celebration. It's what leads up to doing that. And you know that when you harvest an animal, you're harvesting it. As far as I can speak for myself, you know, we eat the food that we take.
People usually use the word harvest for crops, but you're using it for animals. Why is that?
It's a term that's commonly used.
Yeah. But back to when you were young, you said as a hunter, it's a sad moment that when the animal dies, but still when you were young, you had to do it for the first time. As a young girl, how did you get over that?
You know, when I took my first animal, you know, I can't say for a fact that I actually even truly remember the very first one. I can't tell you that. I mean, I can remember probably animals that I've taken, you know, more recently rather than the first animal that I ever took.
Yeah. What kind of hunting do you do? Are you one of these bow and arrow type hunters?
I do all types of hunting. I hunt archery. I hunt rifle. I hunt shotgun. I also shoot with a pistol. So I kind of multifaceted when it comes to that.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about your background. You were a police officer.
Yes.
Where about?
I was a police officer in the Bay Area for 5 years.
Yeah. And so you had to fire guns there too.
Yes. You have to be trained, actually, in the use of firearms, obviously.
Yes. Is that what led you into police work? The fact that as a kid you had been hunting and fishing and you became comfortable with firearms?
No. The firearms aspect of it really I don't even think came into play. I went to college at Cal State East Bay. I got my Bachelor of Science degree in Criminal Justice Administration. And truly, I didn't know what I was going to do with that. I knew it was a field that I was very interested in, but I really didn't know where I was going to go with it. And one of my professors, who I'd become friends with, told me that he had found a job for me. And I said, oh, is it as a police officer? And he said, yes. And there were only a couple agencies that I would have actually considered. And this just happened to be one of them. So
why? What was it about the agency?
I think that I felt that the agency was extremely professional. They had a very good benefits package. They had a great pay package. They had a good reputation. So it was one of the few that I actually would have considered going to work for.
But you didn't stay long, just 5 years.
I retired on a disability. Oh. I tore a ligament in my wrist and had my bones fused.
Yeah. And then you stayed in the law enforcement business as an investigator and then working for a district attorney's office, but then you became a realtor. How did that happen?
Well, actually, in between that, I owned a promotions company, and I sold my promotions company and decided to get into real estate because I felt that I was at a time in my life when I could sell that business and start another business and be successful at that. So my timing was awesome. You know, 3.5 years ago, I got into real estate.
Yeah. My guest is Jamie Sustlin. She lives in Loomis, and she's host of The Ultimate Sportsman, a hunting and fishing reality TV show on the Versus channel. The stereotypical image of the hunter, as I'm sure you know, is a good old boy. Probably fair to say you are a glamorous-looking person. Do people go, whoa, you're a hunter?
Yeah, I get that all the time.
Yes.
I do get that. And
Is that unfortunate, or is it nice, or something else?
Well, I don't know that I can say that it's either way. I just feel that you can't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
And when you look at someone, you can't judge them from what you see because they may be, you know, they may be multifaceted. They may have a lot of other things that about them that you just don't know until you actually sit down with them and start asking them questions and learn more about them.
Your show, The Ultimate Sportsman, started airing, I think, at the end of July. So when does it end?
It should end, I believe, December 23rd. There are 22 weekly episodes.
And it's all taped, I suppose, by now. Or are
yes,
you still
yes.
taping it?
Yeah, no, the show is, yeah, it's fully taped and we know who the winner is.
But you can't see.
No, I can't.
You did get to travel a lot, though, didn't you? It seems like you were all over the place.
I did. I lived out of a suitcase for 2 years.
Really? 2 years?
Yes.
My goodness.
Yes. It's a large production to do something like this. A lot of logistics are involved in filming a show of this magnitude.
I can imagine. Well, that's Jamie Suslin of The Ultimate Sportsman. It airs Thursdays at 7 a.m. Pacific on the Versus Channel. It's a hunting and fishing reality TV show. Jamie lives in Loomis. Jamie, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local winemaker and food scientist who invented the process behind Cap'n Crunch cereal. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, we'll hear some of the best musical performances in our studio this year. Today, we're listening again to some of this year's most interesting stories on Insight. Next, the rich life of Haim Gerarie, owner of an Amador County winery. As well as making wine, Gerarie is a scientist and inventor. Among his many creations was the technology behind Cap'n Crunch cereal. When Haim joined us on Insight in March, I asked him how a chemical engineer from Turkey became a winemaker in California.
Well, actually, I was born in Turkey, but I grew up in Israel, and I got my chemical engineering degree in Israel. And then I came to the United States as a young man, and I went to school. I became a food scientist. I have a PhD in food science from the University of Illinois. And then I stayed in the United States. I've been here for many, many years, and I had the opportunity to work on some food products.
Well, including Cap'n Crunch, you were working for the Quaker Oats Company in Illinois at that time, and you developed the technology behind Cap'n Crunch. What does that mean? What was that technology?
Well, the technology is the process for making this breakfast cereal, and I just conceived and developed the process.
Well, what existed before you got involved?
Cap'n Crunch evolved from another breakfast cereal, and that infringed on a patent, and this is Life cereal. And so they wanted to produce a product like Life cereal that was made using a different method. And this is where, you know, I got involved.
And what was the method you devised?
The method was by extrusion, extruding rather than with using rolls for creating the shape.
And what do you mean by extrusion?
Extrusion is like a meat grinder, like having a barrel and a screw and pushing this dough through a die that has little holes and creating the strands and then shaping them into the shape of a pillow.
Was that your job at that time, to invent processes for making food?
Well, they hired me as a food scientist in product development. And this is actually what I did most of my life as a food scientist. I developed products, and I went on from Quaker to other companies. And even though you're not asking me this question,
go ahead.
And then after Quaker, I went to work for Del Monte, And I did the same thing. I developed the pudding cups. At the time, they were in small aluminum cans, and now they are in plastic containers.
So what did you have to develop in order to make that possible?
Well, the technology of putting these products in a little can existed. I just worked on the formulation, and this was something novel that at the time they didn't have any like puddings in a can.
Do you enjoy eating Cap'n Crunch cereal and puddings in a cup?
Oh, wow. You should not have asked me this question. some products that I developed, I enjoy them, and some others. Most of the time, I'm told, actually, how to make the products and how they should taste. And so, you know, at times, you know, I was told. You know, I don't necessarily, you know, enjoy, you know, that the taste is something very individual, very,
it's your job.
very subjective.
My guest is Chaim Gourarieh. He's a winemaker and owner of the CGDRE winery between Plymouth and Placerville in Amador County. I read that you were also earlier in your career part of a team that developed projects related to life support in space. Given what you were otherwise doing at the time, I guess it was to do with the food the astronauts would eat in space.
Yes, I was. I worked, actually, this was between Quaker and Del Monte. I worked for a company called United Technology Center in Sunnyvale, and I was in their life sciences department, and we were working on life support in space, which included, you know, this project that you mentioned.
What are the challenges for the food scientists trying to make food products that will be usable in space?
Well, at the time, I mean, it doesn't apply now, but at the time they wanted to make a food that had no waste and without any waste. So I put together a formulation that consisted of all the nutrients that are required for sustaining life, but without having any fiber, any waste. So people that went on this after a couple of weeks, they just did not go to the bathroom.
During all these years of working on breakfast cereal and puddings in a cup and space food, did you think about wine? Did you think that one day you'd get into the wine business?
Actually, I was thinking about wine all the time. I discovered wine in the early 70s when I met my wife. I met my wife in California after I moved to California from Chicago. And she introduced me to wine. And I started developing a curiosity and a passion for wine. And and for 30 years, I wanted to get to become a winemaker. But the closest I've done during these 30 years that was related to wine was getting involved in developing, and this was after I had my own company, developing non-alcoholic wine. I had a project for non-alcoholic wine hired by Seagram and also wine coolers. I didn't make any wine. It took me 30 years before I started making wine.
And now as a winemaker, are you still the inventor? Are you still figuring out new and better ways of doing things?
I am. I mean, this is in my nature. And so, yes, definitely.
And you're not just a passive owner of a winery. You're actively involved
actually,
in the winemaking.
I am up to my neck. I am. I'm the winemaker. In the wine business, you have to wear many hats in order to be able to survive. And I enjoy this very much. This is a part of my life.
How's the wine business doing right now with the recession? People have been cutting back on quote-unquote luxury expenses. Did wine come into that category?
It did. It definitely did. And the wines, actually, I think that the overall sales of wine is up, but people are buying less expensive wines. And so this is the trend. So my wines are in the middle. price-wise. The price point of my wines is between $15 to $35. And so the higher priced wines are being affected in this economy.
And how did you choose what kinds of wines you'd make at your winery, CGDRE? Are they the wines that you happen to like, or was it just a business decision that these were the best wines to make?
Well, I only make wines that I like. I don't make wines that just for the business. And my style of wine is one that I like. I don't want to please the wine spectator or, you know, to make wines that necessarily that rate high that I don't like. And the varieties that I use are also the same. But since I've been in the food business for a long time and I've made new products, so I kind of have a feel what people like. So most of the time, what I make, people accept it and they like it.
And can someone like you always tell which is which?
Always is a
strong
big word.
Yes.
Not always, but depends. If these wines have some of the varietal characteristics, then I will be able to tell.
Chaim Gourarie, winemaker, owner of the CGDRE winery between Plymouth and Placerville. He's also a food scientist and inventor, created many products, including the process for Cap'n Crunch cereal. Chaim Gourarie, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Thanks to our associate producers, Lynn Weaver and Sosin Marar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jan Picard. And we'll be back tomorrow. Live music is an important part of Insight, and on our final show of 2010, we'll listen again to some of this year's standouts, including the comic retro jazz of the Free Badge Serenaders, the indie rock of Sea of Bees, the Celtic sounds of 9/8 Irish, and much more. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.